Welcome to the 15th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
Welcome to the podcast that's entirely free from ICC meddling.
And of course, this week we're lamenting the death of runners, one of those wonderful quirks of the game that has never really, as far as I've been able to tell, worked in the batsman's favour.
I'm not really sure that this upset anybody, really, the existence of runners, but the ICC have decided that enough was enough and they've gone. So, consigned to history.
And another part of the rich tapestry of the game that's been taken away. Another part of the, another fairly constant part of the game has been England failing at one-day internationals, and we've had a good view of that happening again in
Alistair Cook's reign as one-day international captain is underway. How do you think, how's it been for him as a start?
It always seems to me, whenever England appoint a new one-day captain, it always seems to me a little bit like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Because as far as I can tell, England have simply never got limited overs cricket right. And I don't think it's about the captain. I think it's just a chronic failure in English cricket to understand what it's all about. I mean, it goes back to things about the fact that our counties play 40-over games, whereas internationally we play 50-over games. And I feel a little bit sorry for Alistair Cook, who's been put in there probably for the wrong reasons, probably because he's been being groomed for the Test captaincy.
Well, this is the point. It's not clear, and the questions that a lot of people have raised has been, would he be in there on merit alone? Or has he been, as you said, chosen there to sort of build him up as a potential test captain?
Well, there's the point that he wasn't in the side until he was captain.
It was fairly obvious, yeah. I mean, I do sometimes wonder, getting away from Cook for a moment, we'll definitely be back on him. But I do wonder how bad this England side is. I mean, I actually felt, coming into the World Cup, there were quite a few signs of promise. Yep. We'd had a couple of good ODI series. And the odd thing about the World Cup is that, much as it's been generally considered a complete disaster, I mean, things like the England batting performance against India in that tournament, and the resilience, I suppose, in sort of getting through those games against the West Indies, there were signs of promise. I mean, I think there are signs that this England side is going somewhere, but it's, I mean, particularly this issue of those big hitting top order batsmen. I mean, that remains perhaps the most obvious gap.
I think it goes beyond, though, the individual players per se, and just the fact that England don't ever seem to have a particularly clear strategy. And so, for instance, when Cook went out and made 119 off 143 balls, which I thought was actually very good in England. It was, you know, runnable, nearly...
Well, runnable, not really runnable, is it?
But not far off, like, give or take a runnable. That one of the problems was that, you know, that's what he does best. That's what he was going to do. He's not the kind of person who's going to go and hit 50 off 17 balls. He's not a Graham Napier. But what the team didn't seem to have worked out how best to use that and how best to build an innings around it. And what a lot of the most successful one-day sides in cricket at the moment is they seem to have a strategy as to how they're going to approach innings, whereas England seems to just go out and just play, and if it happens, it happens, and if it doesn't, it doesn't.
I mean, we've had this, you know, we've had this disagreement. I do feel that Cook's innings, his 100, was one of the few occasions on which 100s actually hurt a player's reputation, simply because we all know that Cook can stick it out. We all know that he can tough it out in difficult conditions. But what we really needed to see was his ability to accelerate, to pick up the tempo. I just don't feel like he showed that. He's a brilliant test opener, but my concern would be that actually, from an opposition point of view, scoring runs at the rate he does, on a good pitch in particular, in good conditions, I would be quite relaxed.
There was an extraordinary period in the second batting power play where there were no boundaries. I think I'm right in saying there were no boundaries off the batting power play that England took.
Yeah.
But I disagree in as much as that I think Cook's innings could have been useful if the others had played around it.
Well, sure.
Part of the problem is that if you have Cook and Trott in the same side. They're very similar batsmen, and they can fulfil a very similar role, which is, if you want to put it sort of derogatorily, is holding up an end. But I would rather think of it as kind of providing a rock around which the innings can be built.
The interesting thing is that we're kind of desperate for a sort of Sehwag or Gale-type figure, but actually you don't necessarily need that. I mean, Sachin Tendulkar is a fantastic example of an utterly classical player, but he does tend to score. You look at, for example, the innings he played against England in that World Cup. You know, he will score at a run a ball. He might start slowly. Yep. And that, perhaps, I would just say, is the difference between someone like him and someone like Cook, who neither of them are players who I think have the sort of pure, raw strength to kind of smash sixes all over the place. Well, but that I just think we're at a... The ODIs have developed to the stage where I think if you're going to hang around, the expectation is that you have to score at a run a ball, if not better now, actually.
Well, either way, it's been a tricky start to his tenure as captain, with Stuart Broad going so completely off the boil.
Stuart Broad appears to have gone mental.
And all of those questions and questions surrounding the batting performance and everything, I don't think Cook's going to have... If England thought that they could ease him into the Test captaincy by giving him the one-day leadership, they're sort of... Civilian.
No, and it'll be interesting to see whether there's still a lack of stability in the side. It'll be interesting to see whether Cook feels able to settle on a more consistent 11. I mean, aside from the ODIs, we've had a really quite interesting test series. India out in the West Indies. Mm. I mean, at a time when there's a lot of talk of test cricket maybe splitting into two tiers, I mean, this is a contest between number one and number seven. I mean, have you felt it's been a mismatch?
It's interesting because it hasn't really been a contest between number one and number seven, and India have done their admirable best to bridge that two-tier system by sending over very much. You wouldn't call it a second string team, but it's certainly not their full strength side.
No.
And there has been a feeling throughout this series that this has been... A basement tussle is completely the wrong phrase to use, but it hasn't been full of high quality cricket. It's been, in a sense, a war of attrition. There haven't been any innings in the first two tests. There haven't been any innings over 300.
Part of it we there does seem to have been an effort to create pitches with a bit more life, especially in the second test. But I think you're quite right. I mean, this hasn't been a full strength India side. I mean, I think it's been quite an odd series in that there's been plenty of excitement. I found it a very easy series to follow and enjoy.
And India have had opportunities as well,
But I think the odd thing is it's been exciting, but generally I felt like India have had control thereabouts. For a West Indies team that, you know, constantly under pressure to sort of turn things around, I mean, do you think this series represents a breakthrough as yet, or is this just more of the depressing same? I mean, Otis Gibson and Darren Sammy badly need a breakthrough.
Yeah, they do. I've been doing some minor statistical analysis.
I'm very excited about this.
In my spare time. And in this series, surprisingly, the Windies have only used four bowlers in the first two tests. None of them have gone for more than 3.5 runs and over, and most of them have been bowling at below 3 runs and over. And three of the bowlers, Edwards, Bishu and Rampal, have been averaging under 30. Now, go back to the largely rained-off series against Sri Lanka last year. It was last year, wasn't it?
In the Sri Lankan monsoon season, good example of ICC scheduling.
There you go. In that series, there are three tests. The Windies used seven bowlers. Two averaged under 25, but then the next best averaged 52. And what's been quite impressive about the West Indies in this current series against India is that what they've actually learned to do, dare I say it, which they haven't been able to do before, is actually to be a little bit mediocre. And not to have startling highs and then moments of absolute dire awful. They've learned to actually play quite steadily.
I quite like the look of the bowling attack. I mean, I think the return of Fidel Edwards was actually exciting. I think he was helped by the pitch, but he looked an exciting bowler. And he looked pleased to be back, actually. Rampal, I think, as well, is a better bowler than a lot of people have considered.
He has, and he also knows how to bowl over a period and how to bowl spells, which is why the averages in the team have been so good.
And then, I mean, I suppose the issue is still with a batting lineup that still looks extremely fragile. I mean, they've had two great opportunities where they only really needed to put 300 on the board and they could have taken control of either of the first or second test match. And yet in both cases, there have been a couple of sort of good performances. I mean, Bravo, Bharat and Samuels have all had the odd good innings. But you've just got this sense that it's still very fragile. I mean, we were talking about Fire in Babylon the other week and it's that sense of Calypso cricket. Yeah. I mean, you know, some great shot play and then the wicket gets thrown away, and that's been a bit disappointing.
And you've got quite a good example of that, haven't you?
Well, there was a rather wonderful one in the first test when the West Indies had a tough chase of 300-odd to win, and Barath goes out as if it's a 20-20. Him and Simmons put on 60, maybe even 70-odd in 10 overs, and he flashes at one, goes straight through vacant third slip, and at this point you think the horse has bolted. No. Dhoni moves a third slip anyway, two balls later, flashes another one, catch goes there, and it's just that immaturity and that need to sort of stick things out. But I mean, we've talked about this sort of an Indian second 11, not quite a second 11, but not a first 11 at any rate.
And they've had a very vaunted batting lineup as well, haven't they? There's been a lot said about these Indians.
And I mean, what have any of the young Indians impressed you? I mean, this was in many ways an audition, wasn't it? It was an opportunity to stake your claim ahead of England.
In the last episode of Reverse World Radio, I mentioned that I thought this was a moment for Ishant Sharma to stand up and be counted. He's been fairly quiet of late, actually. Mm. He needs to sort of convert himself from being very much when he bursts onto the test scene at the age of 17, I think.
Yeah, he was extremely young, wasn't he?
That kind of prodigious sort of fiery bowler that he was, he needs to actually turn himself into the player around which the Indian bowling lineup can sort of work.
I mean, he seemed to be helped by a pitch that there was uneven bounce and issues like that, but I mean, I think there was
16 wickets at 13.62.
Difficult to argue with. And at the same time, I think going into the England series, he is a player who you now feel like India will look to, you know, whatever pitches we get in England.
On the other side of the fence, as we mentioned, no scores over 300, which is a surprise for India. You would have thought that they would have been looking to.
Well, I mean, one of their young batsmen who I expected to have a very good series was Virat Kohli. Maybe he'll come good in the third test if he plays in the third test. I mean, he looked fantastic, I thought, in the World Cup. And you get this point, I think, with young players where you feel they've made the breakthrough. And I really felt like he had in the World Cup. He looked fantastic. And he's really looked very out of sorts.
Very much levelled out.
And also, particularly, that issue of how he dealt with difficult conditions, he looked all at sea. And that will be a consideration for the Indian selectors, because England will provide some challenging conditions. And Kohli simply looked sort of out of sorts. Away from the international arena, it's been all 2020 back at home.
It has, which means that I've been largely out of the loop, unfortunately.
It is impossible to follow. I mean, keeping track of this thing.
I try to do a statutory half hour on Crick Info every day, and it's mostly because the Windies India series has been so compelling. That's why I spend most of my time. But what I have been impressed by, Nottinghamshire. Who their 4-day challenge has been, well, defence of their 4-day title has been sternly, well, it's been faltering quite badly. But they're sitting very prettily at the top of the 2020 table, and actually what I think their success is based on is exactly what I was saying about the England side, which is that you don't need to do anything particularly spectacular. You just need to work together well as a team and as a unit. And they've been doing that very well. Darren Pattinson, let's not mention his name in connection with England too much, has been looking very good with the ball. The young English batsman Alex Hales has been batting
well. I mean,
I've
seen Hales' name thrown around as a potential English England T20 or England ODI opener. And I mean, he's making a very strong case for himself.
Yes, I mean, he's regularly making 40s and 60s. And Samrit Patel is also doing very well with
yeah, and
with
has got himself back in the England reckoning. It's a very similar case at Kent, really, where things are going horribly wrong in the 4-day form of the game. But really, two very, very shrewd acquisitions in Mahmood and Riaz, who are both, you know, two Pakistani players at sort of opposite ends of their career, but both very capable with bat and ball. And they have that sort of, you know, that sort of indefinable sort of Pakistani ability to swing the ball and to use the sort of, to seam the ball in a way that, you know, it's almost become a Pakistani speciality. And it's
so difficult to play when you're trying to, sort of at the end of the innings, when you're trying to...
Well, exactly,
really
in this format. I mean, it's, you know, you do this sort of that well in this format, and it's very hard to score quickly. And both of them have chipped in with very useful runs as well on top of that. And, I mean, Kent might look like they should scrape through in the tournament, which will certainly be a boost to their season.
So, from the archives, and I decided that this week we're going to go back further into the past than we'd ever been before and go back to the 19th century, back to 1878. And it's not even an international match. We're going to go for the Cambridge University Cricket Club against the MCC.
And it seemed about time that, you know, this whole feature from the archives, it was about time we really dug back into the past and found a game, a sort of a bit of an oddity. A game when cricket was just a very, very different game.
It was. When you're reading about it, it sort of takes you a while to find your feet as you're...
You sort of have to adapt, don't you?
Yeah, cricket had been played at Cambridge University since the early 18th century. And the club made its first-class debut in 1817 and went on to become an official club in 1820. It started off life playing games against Eton College on the one hand and Cambridge Town on the other. The games against Eton College were, as you can probably imagine them, all sort of top hats and etc. And the games against Cambridge Town were these huge grudge matches which would just end up in sort of...
That sounds fantastic. We should do it from the archives in one of those. That sounds
exactly.
Brilliant.
And actually, a lot of the games were played on Parker's Piece, which is about half a mile from where we're recording.
Where we are right now.
Which is also where Jack Hobbs learned how to bat. So there we go. So the cricket had been going strongly in Cambridge for a while. It was the team was always one very much of mavericks. In an age which was divided between professionals and amateurs, they were the most privileged amateurs. They were playing purely for the enjoyment of the game. And this all meant that some of the matches were quite remarkable. In 1870, one Frank Cobden took a hat-trick in the last three balls of the Varsity match, when Oxford were only three short of their chase.
I mean, that is death bowling, isn't it?
That's, which is Lassie Malinga, eat your heart out. Frank Cobden is our man. But the finest moment, and indeed the finest team in Cambridge University's history, came in 1878, where the match we're going to look at against the MCC came from. The side won eight games this summer, which is still a record, and they also defeated Australia at Lords.
Isn't it? A university team taking out an international
side.
When you
look at the early season fixtures now that the universities play against the counties...
They tend to be always, these rather pathetic warm-ups,
the counties make 580 for two declared, and then the universities are sort of 137 and 230.
Although, funny enough, Cambridge did, for the first time in a long time, didn't they? They beat Surrey, I think, this year, which was a bit of a shock, wasn't it? But you're quite right, it's generally become a bit of... And there are a couple of notable names on the Cambridge side.
There certainly are. There was one Ivo Bly who famously went after the Ashes had been created, as it were, after the obituary in the Sporting Times. He was the captain who went down to Australia straight afterwards and got them back and wrestled them back from the Aussies. The other, perhaps even more remarkable cricketer was Alan Steele, the all-rounder, who had made his debut for Lancashire before he came up to Cambridge. And when he started playing for the university, he took 75 wickets in his first eight games at an average of 7.42. And it wasn't just a flash in the pan. He was regarded by his peers as being bettered only by W.G. Grace. And he went on later on in his career to do remarkable things against the Australians.
And I thought Wisden had a rather wonderful description of it, didn't it? They said sort of he owed his success to a certain trickiness with the usual results that as batsmen found his tricks out, so he did he become rather less effective. That idea of a tricky bowler I sort of very much like.
Exactly, but I think this sort of typifies the Cambridge side at the time, being real mavericks. But anyway, here we are in 1878 at Lords, the scene is sad.
And Cambridge win the toss, they decide to have a bat. While they lose Lucas to an early run out, the Littleton brothers, I think there are a few brothers actually involved in this game, sort of get Cambridge off to a solid enough start, get them up to 70 for one. I mean, we were having this discussion before the podcast. I mean, this was a time where generally scores would have been that bit lower. I mean, particularly, I think we're thinking, you know, the era obviously of uncovered pitches. From there, though, that good position of 70 for one, Cambridge slide to sort of 133 all out, which probably by this time would still be below expectations.
Slightly below par.
Good position. I mean, George Hearn, a Kent medium pacer who would play one test for England, does the damage for the MCC, taking 5 for 69. It's interesting, just, you know, a few of the quirks of the era. We're talking about a very different game. I mean, he bowls 44 overs. His opening partner, Arnold Rylett, bowls 39. Yeah. Must be said they're four ball overs, but still,
it's a lot of balls.
Very impressive.
Is it, I'm just trying to remember off the top of my head, and I'm going to show myself up as a complete ignoramus because I should have looked this up.
You're always at your best when you try and come up with these stats mid-podcast.
I think this is very much around the time when overarm bowling was legalised. I think overarm bowling was legalised in the 1860s. So, I don't know how this is, and I may be completely wrong, that's just something I sort of plucks off the top of my head. But it's certainly a time when the game is changing.
The game's changing. I mean, the economy rate is something quite astonishing. I mean, 133, Cambridge's 133 came off 98 overs. Which even, if you consider them four ball overs,
is 60 odd overs.
Well, yeah, it's so steady
it's,
stuff.
It's, I mean, it's slower than two and over.
Well, exactly. I mean, in our 2020 era when, you know, you can get 133 coming off sort of, you know, 10, 12 overs, it certainly is something. And, you know, says something, I suppose, about the patience of the crowd, aside from anything else.
So Cambridge are 1-3-3 after their first.
The MCC's reply never really gets going, thanks to the excellent Alan Steele. I mean, he takes 7 for just 34. Five batsmen, four without scoring. A notable contribution from Walter Haddo, who puts in a pretty stalwart effort for the MCC.
And Alan Steele bowls through the innings as well, which you don't see very
don't
much.
See
when,
too when often.
You think that it's a 55 over innings. He's there bowling 20.
Goes the whole way. No, I mean, Haddo comes in at 3 with the score on 9, finishes unbeaten on 26. So he witnesses nine partners dismissed at the other end, and only scores
26. That's a Cook-esque innings.
So, Cook-esque composure, certainly. And Cambridge, in response, sort of in a good position by this stage. They get to 120 for 3. Again, good effort from the Littleton brothers. But the rest of the order doesn't contribute that much. Their last 7 wickets go down, and they finish on 173. Again, Hearn does the damage, taking 7 for 54. It's a steep chase of 237 for the MCC.
Fourth innings on a wearing pitch.
On a wearing pitch at Lord's. And they don't really ever get close. A rather interesting fellow, Alan Stratford, makes 44 for them. Then of Middlesex, he'll go on to represent the USA, interestingly enough, although certainly not originally from the US. The MCC finish all out for 120. The real story, though, is Steele, who again takes 7 wickets and finishes with, you know, ridiculous figures in any era of 14 for 80. I mean, one of the reasons I certainly enjoyed looking at this game was it's fun to go back to that time of, you know, you use the word of mavericks, of characters. And also this time, it's intriguing to kind of look at a time when the whole way cricket functioned was different.
Yeah. And also, you think of the quirks of the game, really, and the fact that Alan Stratford, who'd go on to play for the USA. I mean, you don't really think of many English cricketers going on to play for the USA nowadays, even when we think of cricket as a much more global sport.
I mean, and there's a lot of false romanticism about this idea of sort of amateurs and professionals, and we kind of, you know that there was actually something quite unpleasant, actually, about that distinction. But, I mean, do you feel any nostalgia for this time when, you know, you'd have Cambridge University taking out Australia? I mean, it's quite a
nice idea, isn't it, the fact that this bunch of students can go out and, you know, most of them with cracking hands. There's a very good book actually, a history of Cambridge University Cricket Club, which talks about the way that before quite a lot of their games they'd have these huge banquets and they'd all go out half blind from their hangovers from before. And there is, I mean, it's a ridiculous setup, and of course it certainly couldn't survive.
It could never last.
Era of professionalism. But there is something quite fun.
And you do sort of think it would be really fun just to have watched one of these games,
yep,
just to see exactly what it would have been like. To the book review, and we're going back to 1949, Len Hutton's Cricket Is My Life.
Len Hutton, I didn't really know where you start talking about Len Hutton. Widely considered to be the most technically correct batsman ever to play for England. In 1938, 6, 7, In
the 1930s?
In the late 1930s, at the age of 22, he made 364, which was the highest ever test score at the time, eclipsing Don Bradman's score made in 1930 against England. He went on to
Bradman apparently didn't think very much of the innings. Apparently described it as a very unattractive innings.
Yeah, unattractive was the interesting word. As a character, he's a Yorkshireman, of course, born in Pudsey, St. Lawrence. He makes a startling impact before the war. During the war, Second World War, he is injured and spends most of it in hospital. And after the war, comes back and does similarly astonishing things. This book, Cricket Is My Life, goes up to 1947, which was nowhere near the end of his career. He played for a good few years after that.
It's interesting because, you know, we tried to sort of take in this podcast a mix of sort of cricket writing old and new. And I think one thing that struck me reading this, and this isn't meant as a criticism, it really is just meant as a comparison, is the way autobiography has just changed in sport. I mean, a few episodes ago, we looked at Marcus Trezeguet's award-winning autobiography, and there's just a huge shift that's taken place sort of, you know, in the 50-60 years between the two. I mean, the way Trezeguet's book, for example, is more open, more honest. There is something about the sort of autobiographies of this time that are kind of almost more kind of more dignified. There's almost stuff that you don't say.
And whereas with the I think it is something in a sense to do with celebrity culture and the fact that you know, Trezeguet, for instance, talks about his wife quite a lot. Whereas with Len Hutton, I think there are probably he mentions his wife twice and only very, very briefly.
That's some good statistical work there. Two mentions of Hutton's wife.
As sort of half sentences, that summer I got married, full stop. I scored 1,000 runs the next season.
Yeah.
It's literally like that. And I think it's a changing culture. It's also the fact that he was a pretty dour Yorkshireman.
Mm.
And cricket was his life. I mean, there wasn't much else for him to.
It's a very conventional book. I mean, it's lovely in the sense that it starts from his first trial, doesn't it, for Yorkshire? Yeah. He's walking in the snow to trials at Headingley, and there's something very kind of lovely in that. You know, it really is a from childhood to the top of the game kind of book.
There's this beautiful sense of him being immersed in a, of course, Yorkshire were the great county team of the 1930s, which is when Hutton was sort of cutting his teeth, and there's this great story of him being immersed in the sort of Yorkshire culture, and the fact that his he refers to what he calls his cricketing aunts, and I'm not sure many aunts can be described as cricketing, but there's this wonderful sense in which he buys his first bat from Herbert Sutcliffe's sportswear company. He's given Jack Hobbs's annual for one of his birthdays early on. He meets George Hurst, the great Yorkshire all-rounder, at one of his
he
first
has
trials.
This passion and this belief as well that cricket in the north is somehow different. He certainly sees Northern League cricket as streets ahead actually of what it was in the south. You know, he talks about average attendances of 5,000 a game, which a lot of counties would kill for.
And
actually
the other thing that struck me in terms of the difference in the game then is the sheer amount of cricket being played. I mean, we talk about cricketers being overworked nowadays, but when he makes his debut season, starts his test career rather inauspiciously against New Zealand, making scores of 0-1 in his first test. But already before the first test, which I think is in May, he scored 1,000 runs in county cricket before the first test of the series. And he goes on between every test to play two or three county games. Every single moment is spent playing cricket. And it's therefore no wonder almost that you have, I mean, the other astonishing thing is Hedley Verity. He was an astonishing character anyway, the Yorkshire spinner. And basically every page you hear about Hedley Verity taking another 7 foot or 8 foot, 9 foot or 10 foot in the county championship. And actually it's not surprising when there's so much cricket was being played.
It's interesting because what you don't get in terms of an insight into his personality, you certainly do get in terms of an insight into cricket at the time. I mean, what I liked in a way, and I don't think it's patronising to say it, is there's sort of an innocence of the time. I mean, I loved hearing Hutton talk of his excitement, very different figures, talk about his excitement of going on tour to South Africa. And, you know, we talk now about, well, and we have this sort of, this idea now that players are jaded with travel, how actually a lot of them, if they get the opportunity, quite like a break almost. Yep. And I love the idea that for Hutton, at that stage of his career, it was thrilling. You know, you were going to a new country, a new culture. He talks about how it refreshed him, this sort of break. And I thought there was something, it actually made me feel sort of a little bit sad for the fact that now, tours have become less of an adventure and more sort of an obligation.
Where I think the heart of this book lies and where the real interest lies is the way that it charts and the way that Lutton...
We've now Lutton. Attempted three or four different pronunciations of his very straightforward name.
The way that Hutton sits very much between two epochs, and which kind of centre around the Second World War. And the way that when he first plays for Yorkshire, he first plays for England, he's playing with people like Eddie Painter, who was the keeper in the 33-34 Bodyline series, Hedley Verity, who was killed in the Second World War, Herbert Sutcliffe, who retired from international cricket just before the Second World War. So you have that era before the war, and then after the war you have people like Edrich and Compton coming in, and there is a great sense in which this is kind of a turning point in cricket. And actually, one of the most because I was very much I actually only finished the book about an hour ago, and I was very much of your opinion about it being quite dry and quite dour. But actually, when you get to his description of the war and how the war sort of changed him and how post-war he cricket was a very different sort of game, it does actually become very quite moving and quite nostalgic about the sheer destruction that was wrought on something that was so permanent.
It's a bit of a cliche, but you know, it puts things into context, doesn't it? And I thought there was an interesting description of the first innings he played after the war, where I think he got a duck playing for his old club team, and he says, you know, I haven't got the words down, but he basically said, you know, I couldn't have cared, you know, the thrill of being out, of the injuries that he'd suffered during the war, of the pain, just to hold a bat. And you realise that actually what you had then was sport playing, you know, you don't want to make too bold a claims for a sport, but actually in the midst of something that had been so awful, cricket was part of a country's regeneration, you know, to be out there on the fields playing again, for people to be going through the turnstiles at the county grounds again.
And I suppose the victory tests against Australia, of course, after the war were the epitome of that, absolutely. Just to close, two great anecdotes.
Fantastic anecdotes.
Concerning, we don't have many anecdotes concerning the clergy. On Reverse Threat Radio.
No, Hutton's a fan of the clergy, isn't he? He a lot of his anecdotes are clergy.
They are clergy-based, as I think they... I mean, in Yorkshire society at the time, the church and the cricket club were the two big things. But the one which really caught my eye was that apparently young boys used to sort of collect after church conferences and get autographs from the bishops and the archbishops,
which is a great anecdote in itself, actually,
which is an unfamiliar scene to me. But there's a story about one boy saying to another one, look, I'll swap you 20 archbishops for a Len Hutton in terms of the autographs. But there was another one you spotted.
There's another rather lovely one of a clergyman who saw a boy playing out in the street and made a comment along the lines of, oh, you know, you're the next Don Bradman. And the boy sort of shakes his head and says, no, I'm the next Len Hutton. And that rather lovely moment when you become a great cricketer, the moment when, you know, the kids playing on the street want to be you. But I mean, sort of in summarise, it's a very worthwhile book to read, perhaps for an insight into the time, isn't it? As much as it is an insight into him.
And just 1 pence from Amazon, I think we got it. It's well worth it.
Very difficult to argue with that value. From the blogs, and this week we have a sort of relatively rare beast of the cricket blogging world. We've got a blog based in New York, I'm pretty sure it's based in New York, written by an Indian writer, Ducking Beamers is the name. You know, we've generally, for this feature, we look for any blog that we like, that we think sort of does something good. I mean, I suppose the freedom of the blogosphere, you know, your ability to write about what you want to write, is something that some bloggers exploit and some bloggers don't. So some bloggers will have the sort of exact same debate that all the mainstream press is having about, you know, do it, did England play well today, you know, that kind of thing. Yep. What I like about Ducking Beamers is its willingness to kind of focus on sort of the odd issues. I mean, we've got some great title posts here. The Nerdy Sheik of Rahul Dravid is just a fantastic title for a post. The post that I have to say caught both of our attention, I think, is this Why Watch Cricket Highlights.
And I recently received a copy of the 2010-11 Ashes box set. All 5 DVDs of it, however many hours that constitutes. And it's an absolute delight, I must say, because I love watching England beating the Australians. But the thing that I've always thought about cricket highlights is that it's fine for one day as where the defining moments really are the fours and the sixes and the wickets. But actually for tests, it's very, very difficult to get a sense of the rhythm of the game. And there are moments where, for instance, I've just watched the first test, and the moments where Haddin and Hussey are building that huge partnership in the first innings.
Painful stuff, that.
It is painful stuff. But the other thing is, you don't really know. You spend half an hour and you just watch fours and that's it.
Yeah.
And you don't know if that's happened in the space of five overs or in the space of a day.
No, I mean, it's a fascinating... The reason why, you know, a great post should draw your attention to something you haven't thought about before.
No,
I mean,
exactly.
That's something we've mentioned before in this feature. And I read that post and I just thought, that's fantastic. Because actually, you know, much like you, I'm someone who, you know, collects sort of particularly DVDs of England's victories. And, you know, I will watch cricket highlights.
Few and far between. We've got a small collection.
Yeah, and, you know, there's the reality that none of us have the time, you know, much as we would love to watch every moment of every test. So we're all quite reliant on cricket highlights. But it was a really interesting post just drawing your attention to the fact, well, what are we getting out of it? I mean, are we watching it purely because we need our cricket hit, or are we getting a sort of, a good product?
It's interesting how it compares to other sports, and Duck and Beamers makes a very valid point that watching tennis highlights is pretty dull.
Yes, tennis definitely doesn't work.
It doesn't really work in the same way as a game. But actually, watching football highlights, for instance, is actually quite a good way of...
I'm certainly the opinion that sort of football highlights generally work. I mean, interesting thing, sort of we try to, whenever we sort of profile a blog, look at sort of what's the sort of unique feature of it. I mean, what I quite like about the posts here is they're of that kind of weird medium length, whereby they're not those really brief blog posts that just kind of make one...
Yeah.
Frankly, often slightly inane
point.
Almost Twitter posts that kind of launch an outlandish opinion on something without any justification. And neither are they essays, but they're just quite well read, sort of quite well thought through posts on a sort of variety of issues. And sort of, you know, a good breadth actually as well. You know, we've got a lot on the West Indies, for example, here as well. And that willingness, I suppose, not to focus excessively on one team is very important for a good blog.
It is. It's a very interesting blog and well worth a browse. Dare I say it, though, one small criticism...
This upset you a little bit. Get it out, Toby.
Which I couldn't let go unnoticed, which is that in the About section, we are told that the man who asked what do they know of cricket, who only cricket know, was the late, great Neville Cardus, whereas, in fact, it was the late, great C.L.R. James. There's our minor criticism. But aside from that, we can forgive that, because it is a fantastic blog. And
a good blog. Duckingbeamers.wordpress.com.
So, on to the debate, and one of the... Well, there are several hot topics at the moment, and we're going to leave the ICC and their shenanigans well alone.
What they've done to the DRS is too complicated for us to understand, unfortunately.
It certainly is, and so you'll have to go on to Cricket Info to have a good look at that. The old guardians of the game, the MCC, there's been a question as to whether when the West Indies next visit England... for a test match tour, whether they're going to be playing at Lord's.
Traditionally seen as a right, almost, to the visiting side. You know, you come to England, you get a test match at Lord's.
Exactly, and as far as I can tell, and I mean, I'm constantly being pilloried as the staunch traditionalist and these kind of things. As far as I can tell, it's actually one of the things that makes a tour to England what it is, for both English and for overseas players. I mean, there's all this thing that... about getting on the honours board at Lord's. And actually, I think it is as big a deal almost as everyone's had.
So you're not as fussed about the honours board at the Swalek Stadium, for
example? I'm certainly not as... I mean...
No.
The fact,
I'd get on the honours board anywhere, frankly, but...
Well, no, quite. It doesn't need the slant of the
I'm
pitch.
Really torn on this, because I can very much see the traditionist angle of Lord's. I think if I was coming from, you know, anywhere in the world, and, you know, maybe it was my one tour of England, maybe I wouldn't get on another tour. You know, the opportunity to play at Lord's is one you would kill for. But, all that being said, with so many county grounds desperate to sort of host the test, that sort of monopoly, Lord's getting a guaranteed test every series, is tough on some of the other counties. I mean, I'm slightly being devil's advocate there, because I'm not entirely certain what I think myself on it.
I agree slightly, and I agree that we there is a duty almost to be spreading the game around the counties. But, I think actually that the... It's a tricky one. Actually, the decentralisation of the game has led to quite a lot of the faults in the game in recent years. The fact that the MCC has lost quite a lot of its power, not only its official power, but its kind of status, has meant that some of the rampant commercialisation of the game has been able to take off.
And I'm not
saying that by an MCC team not playing at Lords, therefore the game
will be reversed.
Has gone to the dogs.
Yeah, you've taken quite a large leap there.
But I do think that some of the bastions of tradition do actually serve a purpose in preserving some of the good parts of the game as we
know. One thing that's evident is the West Indies, if they are the team concerned, or other teams, if it comes to that, will be upset about this. You know, they will be disappointed. I mean, the other thing I think to say is that I thought it was great. I was a great supporter, I think, of when Test cricket went to Cardiff. I thought it was fun. I didn't get the chance to go to the most recent Test there, but I, you know, from all accounts, a great stadium. What I think is concerning, and you know, there are a lot of excuses to be made in terms of the weather, in terms of a game that was frankly not a very good game for most of it, the attendances were appalling for this Test match.
Yep.
And it has raised real concerns, because ultimately, a lot of these counties, when they bid for these Test matches and then get them and then don't get the crowds, it often tends to be a little bit of a disaster.
I suppose it's a balance between playing to your strengths and being sort of evangelical and going out there and finding new cricket audiences within the country.
I mean, perhaps those outgrounds need to make more of an effort, and perhaps given time, there'll be more success there. So, you know, I think we're sticking on the traditional space just about here. Thank you very much for sticking with us. We'll be back in a couple of weeks' time, building up, I think, by then to what should be a thrilling England-India series. See you in 2 weeks' time.